Chapter 5 Letters from Home. For the next 3 weeks, Anne and Priscilla continued to feel as strangers in a strange land. Then, suddenly, everything seemed to fall into focus. Redmond, professors, classes, students, studies, social doings. Life became homogeneous again, instead of being made up of detached fragments. The freshmen, instead of being a collection of unrelated individuals, found themselves a class with a class spirit, a class yell, class interests, class antipathies, and class ambitions. They won the day in the annual arts rush against the sophomores, and thereby gained the respect of all the classes, and an enormous confidence-giving opinion of themselves. For 3 years the sophomores had won in the rush. That the victory of this year perched upon the freshmen's banner was attributed to the strategic generalship of Gilbert Blythe, who marshaled the campaign and originated certain new tactics, which demoralized the sophs and swept the freshmen to triumph. As a reward of merit, he was elected president of the freshman class, a position of honor and responsibility, from a fresh point of view at least, coveted by many. He was also invited to join the Lambs, Redmond E's for Lambda Theta, a compliment rarely paid to a freshman. As a preparatory initiation ordeal, he had to parade the principal business streets of Kingsport for a whole day wearing a sunbonnet and a voluminous kitchen apron of gaudily flowered calico. This he did cheerfully, doffing his sunbonnet with courtly grace when he met ladies of his acquaintance. Charlie Sloane, who had not been asked to join the Lambs, told Anne he did not see how Blythe could do it, and he, for his part, could never humiliate himself so. "Fancy Charlie Sloane in a calico apron and a sunbonnet," giggled Priscilla. "He'd look exactly like his old grandmother Sloane. Gilbert now looked as much like a man in them as in his own proper habiliments." Anne and Priscilla found themselves in the thick of the social life in Redmond. That this came about so speedily was due in great measure to Philippa Gordon. Philippa was the daughter of a rich and well-known man, and belonged to an old and exclusive blue-nose family. This, combined with her beauty and charm, a charm acknowledged by all who met her, promptly opened the gates of all cliques, clubs, and classes in Redmond to her. And where she went, Anne and Priscilla went too. Phil adored Anne and Priscilla, especially Anne. She was a loyal little soul, crystal free from any form of snobbishness. "Love me, love my friends," seemed to be her unconscious motto. Without effort, she took them with her into her ever-widening circle of acquaintanceship, and the two Avonlea girls found their social pathway to Redmond made very easy and pleasant for them, to the envy and wonderment of the other freshettes, who, lacking Philippa's sponsorship, were doomed to remain rather on the fringe of things during their first college year. To Anne and Priscilla, with their more serious views of life, Phil remained the amusing, lovable baby she had seemed on her first meeting. Yet, as she said herself, she had heaps of brains. When or where she found time to study was a mystery, for she seemed always in demand for some kind of fun, and her home evenings were crowded with callers. She had all the beau that heart could desire, for 9/10 of the freshmen and a big fraction of all the other classes were rivals for her smiles. She was naively delighted over this, and gleefully recounted each new conquest to Anne and Priscilla with comments that might have made the unlucky lover's ears burn fiercely. "Alec and Alonzo don't seem to have any serious rival yet," remarked Anne teasingly.
"Not one," agreed Philippa. "I write them both every week and tell them all about my young men here. I'm sure it must amuse them, but of course the one I like best I can't get. Gilbert Blythe won't take any notice of me, except to look at me as if I were a nice little kitten he'd like to pat. Too well I know the reason. I owe you a grudge, Queen Anne. I really ought to hate you, and instead I love you madly, and I'm miserable if I don't see you every day. You're different from any girl I ever knew before. When you look at me in a certain way, I feel what an insignificant, frivolous little beast I am, and I long to be better and wiser and stronger. And then I make good resolutions, but the first nice-looking manny who comes my way knocks them all out of my head. Isn't college life magnificent? It's so funny to think I hated it that first day, but if I hadn't, I might never got really acquainted with you. Anne, please tell me over again that you like me a little bit. I yearn to hear it."
"I like you a big bit, and I think you're a dear, sweet, adorable, velvety, clawless little kitten," laughed Anne, But I don't see when you ever get time to learn your lessons.
Phil must have found time, for she held her own in every class of her year. Even the grumpy old professor of mathematics, who detested co-eds and had bitterly opposed their admission to Redmond, couldn't floor her. She led the freshettes everywhere, except in English, where Anne Shirley left her far behind. Anne herself found the studies of her freshman year very easy, thanks in great part to the steady work she and Gilbert had put in during those 2 past years in Avonlea. This left her more time for a social life, which she thoroughly enjoyed. But never for a moment did she forget Avonlea and the friends there. To her, the happiest moments in each week were those in which letters came from home. It was not until she had got her first letters that she began to think she could ever like Kingsport or feel at home there. Before they came, Avonlea had seemed thousands of miles away. Those letters brought it near and linked the old life to the new so closely that they began to seem one and the same instead of two hopelessly segregated existences. The first batch contained 6 letters from Jane Andrews, Ruby Gillis, Diana Barry, Marilla, Mrs. Lynde, and Davy. Jane's was a copper-plated production with every T nicely crossed and every I precisely dotted, and not an interesting sentence in it. She never mentioned the school, concerning which Anne was avid to hear. She never answered one of the questions Anne had asked in her letter. But she told Anne how many yards of lace she had recently crocheted, and the kind of weather they were having in Avonlea, and how she intended to have her new dress made, and the way she felt when her head ached. Ruby Gillis wrote a gushing epistle deploring Anne's absence, assuring her she was horridly missed in everything, asking what the Redmond fellows were like, and filling the rest with accounts of her own harrowing experiences with her numerous admirers. It was a silly, harmless letter, and Anne would have laughed over it had it not been for the postscript. "Gilbert seems to be enjoying Redmond, judging from his letters," wrote Ruby. "I don't think Charlie is so struck on it." So Gilbert was writing to Ruby. Very well. He had a perfect right to, of course. Only, Anne did not know that Ruby had written the first letter and that Gilbert had answered it from mere courtesy. She tossed Ruby's letter aside contemptuously. But it took all Diana's breezy, newsy, delightful epistle to banish the sting of Ruby's postscript. Diana's letter contained a little too much Fred, but was otherwise crowded and crossed with items of interest, and Anne almost felt herself back in Avonlea while reading it. Marilla's was a rather prim and colorless epistle, severely innocent of gossip or emotion. Yet somehow, it conveyed to Anne a whiff of the wholesome, simple life at Green Gables, with its savor of ancient peace and the steadfast, abiding love that was there for her. Mrs. Lynde's letter was full of church news. Having broken up housekeeping, Mrs. Lynde had more time than ever to devote to church affairs, and had flung herself into them heart and soul. She was at present much worked up over the poor supplies they were having in the vacant Avonlea pulpit. "I don't believe any but fools enter the ministry nowadays," she wrote bitterly. "Such candidates as they have sent us, and such stuff as they preach. Half of it ain't true, and what's worse, it ain't sound doctrine. The one we have now is the worst of the lot. He mostly takes a text and preaches about something else. And he says he doesn't believe all the heathen will be eternally lost. The idea! If they won't, all the money we've been giving to foreign missions will be clean wasted, that's what. Last Sunday night, he announced that next Sunday he'd preach on the axe head that swam. I think he'd better confine himself to the Bible and leave sensational subjects alone. Things have come to a pretty pass if a minister can't find enough in Holy Writ to preach about, that's what. What church do you attend, Anne? I hope you go regularly. People are apt to get so careless about church going away from home. And I understand college students are great sinners in this respect. I'm told many of them actually study their lessons on Sunday. I hope you'll never sink that low, Anne. Remember how you were brought up, and be very careful what friends you make. You never know what sort of creatures are in them colleges. Outwardly, they may be as whited sepulchres, and inwardly, as ravening wolves, that's what. You'd better not have anything to say to any young man who isn't from the island. I forgot to tell you what happened the day the minister called here. It was the funniest thing I ever saw. I said to Marilla, if Anne had been here, wouldn't she have had a laugh?
Even Marilla laughed. You know, he's a very short, fat little man with bow legs. Well, that old pig of Mr. Harrison's, the big tall one, had wandered over here that day again and broke into the yard, and it got into the back porch, unbeknownst to us. And it was there when the minister appeared in the doorway. It made one wild bolt to get out, but there was nowhere to bolt to except between them bow legs. So there it went, and being as it was so big and the minister so little, it took him clean off his feet and carried him away. His hat went one way and his cane another, just as Marilla and I got to the door. I'll never forget the look of him, and that poor pig was near scared to death. I'll never be able to read that account in the Bible of the swine that rushed madly down the steep place into the sea without seeing Mr. Harrison's pig careering down the hill with that minister. I guess the pig thought he had the old boy on his back instead of inside of him. I was thankful the twins weren't about. It wouldn't have been the right thing for them to have seen a minister in such an undignified predicament. Just before they got to the brook, the minister jumped off or fell off. The pig rushed through the brook like mad and up through the woods. Marilla and I run down and help the minister get up and brush his coat. He wasn't hurt, but he was mad. He seemed to hold Marilla and me responsible for it all, though we told him the pig didn't belong to us and had been pestering us all summer. Besides, what did he come to the back door for? He'd never have caught Mr. Allen doing that. It'll be a long time before we get a man like Mr. Allen. But it's an ill wind that blows no good. We've never seen hoof nor hair of that pig since, and it's my belief we never will. Things is pretty quiet in Avonlea. I don't find Green Gables as lonesome as I expected. I think I'll start another cotton warp quilt this winter. Mrs. Silas Sloane has a handsome new apple leaf pattern. When I feel that I must have some excitement, I read the murder trials in that Boston paper my niece sends me. I never used to do it, but they're real interesting. The States must be an awful place. I hope you never go there, Anne. But the way girls roam over the earth now is something terrible. It always makes me think of Satan in the book of Job, going to and fro and walking up and down. I don't believe the Lord ever intended it, that's what. Davy has been pretty good since you went away. One day he was bad, and Marilla punished him by making him wear Dora's apron all day, and then he went and cut all Dora's aprons up. I spanked him for that, and then he went and chased my rooster to death. The McPhersons have moved down to my place. She's a great housekeeper and very particular. She's rooted all my June lilies up because she says they make a garden look so untidy. Thomas set them lilies out when we were married. Her husband seems a nice sort of man, but she can't get over being an old maid, that's what. Don't study too hard. And be sure to put your winter underclothes on as soon as the weather gets cool. Marilla worries a lot about you. But I tell her you've got a lot more sense than I ever thought you would have at one time, and that you'll be all right. Davy's letter plunged into a grievance at the start. Dear Anne, please write and tell Marilla not to tie me to the rail of the bridge when I go fishing. The boys make fun of me when she does. It's awful lonesome here without you, but great fun in school. Jane Andrews is crosser than you. I scare Mrs. Lynde with a Jack-o'-lantern last night. She was awful mad, and she was mad 'cause I chased her old rooster around the yard till he fell down dead. I didn't mean to make him fall down dead. What made him die, Anne, I want to know. Mrs. Lynde threw him into the pig pen. She might have sold him to Mr. Blair. Mr. Blair is giving 50 cents apiece for good dead roosters now. I heard Mrs. Lynde asking the minister to pray for her. What did she do that was so bad, Anne, I want to know. I've got a kite with a magnificent tail, Anne. Milty Bolter told me a great story in school yesterday. It is true. Old Joe Mosey and Leon were playing cards one night last week in the woods. The cards were on a stump, and a big black man bigger than the trees came along and grabbed the cards and the stump and disappeared with a noise like thunder. I'll bet they were scared. Milty says the black man was the old Harry. Was he, Anne? I want to know. Mr. Kimball over at Spencervale is very sick and will have to go to the hospital. Please excuse me while I ask Marilla if that's spelled right. Marilla says it's the asylum he has to go to, not the other place. He thinks he has a snake inside of him. What's it like to have a snake inside of you, Anne? I want to know. Mrs. Lawrence Bell is sick, too. Mrs. Lynde says that all that is the matter with her is that she thinks too much about her insides.
I wonder, said Anne, as she folded up her letters, what Mrs. Lynde would think of Philippa.
Chapter 6 In the Park.
What are you going to do with yourselves today, girls? Asked Philippa, popping into Anne's room one Saturday afternoon.
We're going for a walk in the park, answered Anne. I ought to stay in and finish my blouse, but I couldn't sew on a day like this. There's something in the air that gets into my blood and makes a sort of glory in my soul. My fingers would twitch and I'd sew a crooked seam. So it's ho for the park and the pines.
Does we include anyone but yourself and Priscilla?
Yes, it includes Gilbert and Charlie, and we'll be very glad if it will include you also.
But, said Philippa dolefully, if I go, I'll have to be Gooseberry, and that will be a new experience for Philippa Gordon.
Well, new experiences are broadening.
Come along and you'll be able to sympathize with all poor souls who have to play Gooseberry often. But where are all the victims?
Oh, I was tired of them all and simply couldn't be bothered with any of them today. Besides, I've been feeling a little blue, just a pale, elusive azure. It isn't serious enough for anything darker. I wrote Alec and Alonzo last week. I put the letters into envelopes and addressed them, but I didn't seal them up.
That evening something funny happened. That is, Alec would think it funny, but Alonzo wouldn't be likely to. I was in a hurry, so I snatched Alec's letter, as I thought, out of the envelope and scribbled down a postscript. Then I mailed both letters. I got Alonzo's reply this morning. Girls, I had put that postscript to his letter, and he was furious. Of course, he'll get over it, and I don't care if he doesn't, but it spoiled my day. So I thought I'd come to you darlings to get cheered up.
After the football season opens, I won't have any spare Saturday afternoons. I adore football. I've got the most gorgeous cap and sweater striped in Redmond colors to wear to the games. To be sure, a little way off, I'll look like a walking barber's pole. Did you know that that Gilbert of yours has been elected captain of the freshman football team?
Yes, he told us so last evening, said Priscilla, seeing that outraged Anne would not answer. He and Charlie were down. We knew they were coming, so we painstakingly put out of sight or out of reach all Miss Ada's cushions, that very elaborate one with the raised embroidery I dropped on the floor in the corner behind the chair it was on. I thought it would be safe there. But would you believe it? Charlie Sloan made for that chair, noticed the cushion behind it, solemnly fished it up, and sat on it the whole evening. Such a wreck of a cushion as it was. Poor Miss Ada asked me today, still smiling, but oh, so reproachfully, why I had allowed it to be sat upon. I told her I hadn't, that it was a matter of predestination coupled with inveterate Sloanishness, and I wasn't a match for both combined.
Miss Ada's cushions are really getting on my nerves, said Anne. She finished two new ones last week, stuffed and embroidered within an inch of their lives. There being absolutely no other cushionless place to put them, she stood them up against the wall on the stair landing.
They topple over half the time, and if we come up or down the stairs in the dark, we fall over them. Last Sunday, when Dr. Davis prayed for all those exposed to the perils of the sea, I added in thought, and for all those who live in houses where cushions are loved not wisely but too well. There, we're ready, and I see the boys coming through old St. John's. Do you cast your lot with us, Phil?
I'll go, if I can walk with Priscilla and Charlie. That will be a bearable degree of Gooseberry. That Gilbert of yours is a darling, Anne. But why does he go around so much with goggle eyes?
Anne stiffed. She had no great liking for Charlie Sloan, but he was of Avonlea, so no outsider had any business to laugh at him.
Charlie and Gilbert have always been friends, she said coldly. Charlie is a nice boy. He's not to blame for his eyes.
Don't tell me that. He is. He must have done something dreadful in a previous existence to be punished with such eyes. Pris and I are going to have such sport with him this afternoon. We'll make fun of him to his face and he'll never know it.
Doubtless, the abandoned peas, as Anne called them, did carry out their amiable intentions. But Sloane was blissfully ignorant. He thought he was quite a fine fellow to be walking with two such co-eds, especially Philippa Gordon, the class beauty and belle. It must surely impress Anne. She would see that some people appreciated him at his real value.
Gilbert and Anne loitered a little behind the others, enjoying the calm, still beauty of the autumn afternoon under the pines of the park,
on the road that climbed and twisted around the harbor shore.
"The silence here is like a prayer, isn't it?" said Anne, her face upturned to the shining sky. "How I love the pines! They seem to strike their roots deep into the romance of all the ages. It is so comforting to creep away now and then for a good talk with them. I always feel so happy out here."
And so, in mountain solitudes overtaken, as by some spell divine, their cares drop from them like the needles shaken from out the gusty pine, quoted Gilbert. They make our little ambitions seem rather petty, don't they, Anne?
I think if ever any great sorrow came to me, I would come to the pines for comfort, said Anne dreamily.
I hope no great sorrow ever will come to you, Anne, said Gilbert, who could not connect the idea of sorrow with the vivid, joyous creature beside him, unwitting that those who can soar to the highest heights can also plunge to the deepest depths, and that the natures which enjoy most keenly are those which also suffer most sharply.
But there must, sometime, mused Anne. Life seems like a cup of glory held to my lips just now, but there must be some bitterness in it. There is in every cup. I shall taste mine someday. Well, I hope I shall be strong and brave to meet it, and I hope it won't be through my own fault that it will come. Do you remember what Dr. Davis said last Sunday evening, that the sorrows God sent us brought comfort and strength with them, while the sorrows we brought on ourselves, through folly or wickedness, were by far the hardest to bear? But we mustn't talk of sorrow on an afternoon like this. It's meant for the sheer joy of living, isn't it?
If I had my way, I'd shut everything out of your life but happiness and pleasure, Anne, said Gilbert, in the tone that meant danger ahead.
Then you would be very unwise, rejoined Anne hastily. I'm sure no life can be properly developed and rounded out without some trial and sorrow, though I suppose it is only when we are pretty comfortable that we admit it. Come, the others have got to the pavilion and are beckoning to us.
They all sat down in the little pavilion to watch an autumn sunset of deep red fire and pallid gold. To their left lay Kingsport, its roofs and spires dim in their shroud of violet smoke. To their right lay the harbor, taking on tints of rose and copper as it stretched out into the sunset. Before them the water shimmered, satin smooth and silver gray, and beyond, clean-shaven Williams Island loomed out of the mist, guarding the town like a sturdy bulldog. Its lighthouse beacon flared through the mist like a baleful star, and was answered by another in the far horizon.
Did you ever see such a strong-looking place? Asked Philippa. I don't want Williams Island especially, but I'm sure I couldn't get it if I did. Look at that sentry on the summit of the fort, right beside the flag. Doesn't he look as if he had stepped out of a romance?
Speaking of romance, said Priscilla, we've been looking for Heather, but of course we couldn't find any. It's too late in the season, I suppose.
Heather, exclaimed Anne. Heather doesn't grow in America, does it? There are just two patches of it in the whole continent, said Phil. One right here in the park, and one somewhere else in Nova Scotia, I forget where. The famous Highland Regiment, the Black Watch, camped here one year, and when the men shook out the straw of their beds in the spring, some seeds of heather took root.
Oh, how delightful, said Enchanted Anne.
Let's go home around by Spofford Avenue, suggested Gilbert. We can see all the handsome houses where the wealthy nobles dwell. Spofford Avenue is the finest residential street in Kingsport. Nobody can build on it unless he's a millionaire.
Oh, do, said Phil. There's a perfectly killing little place I want to show you, Anne. It wasn't built by a millionaire. It's the first place after you leave the park, and must have grown while Spofford Avenue was still a country road. It did grow. It wasn't built. I don't care for the houses on the avenue. They're too brand new and plate glassy. But this little spot is a dream, and its name, but wait till you see it.
They saw it as they walked up the pine-fringed hill from the park. Just on the crest where Spofford Avenue petered out into a plain road was a little white frame house with groups of pines on either side of it, stretching their arms protectingly over its low roof. It was covered with red and gold vines, through which its green shuttered windows peeped. Before it was a tiny garden, surrounded by a low stone wall. October though it was, the garden was still very sweet with dear, old-fashioned, unworldly flowers and shrubs. Sweet May, southern wood,
Lemon verbena, alyssum, petunias, marigolds, and chrysanthemums. A tiny brick wall in herringbone pattern led from the gate to the front porch. The whole place might have been transplanted from some remote country village, yet there was something about it that made its nearest neighbor, the big lawn-encircled palace of a tobacco king, look exceedingly crude and showy and ill-bred by contrast. As Phil said, it was the difference between being born and being made. "It's the dearest place I ever saw," said Anne delightedly. "It gives me one of my old delightful funny aches. It's dearer and quainter than even Miss Lavender's stone house."
"It's the name I want you to notice especially," said Phil. "Look, in white letters, around the archway over the gate. Patty's Place. Isn't that killing? Especially on this avenue of Pinehursts and Elmwalds and Cedarcrofts. Patty's Place, if you please. I adore it."
"Have you any idea who Patty is?" asked Priscilla.
"Patty Spofford is the name of the old lady who owns it, I've discovered. She lives there with her niece, and they've lived there for hundreds of years, more or less. Maybe a little less, Anne. Exaggeration is merely a flight of poetic fancy. I understand that wealthy folk have tried to buy the lot time and again. It's really worth a small fortune now, you know. But Patty won't sell upon any consideration. And there's an apple orchard behind the house in place of a backyard. You'll see it when we get a little past. A real apple orchard on Spofford Avenue."
"I'm going to dream about Patty's Place tonight," said Anne. "Why, I feel as if I belonged to it. I wonder if, by any chance, we'll ever see the inside of it."
"It isn't likely," said Priscilla. Anne smiled mysteriously.
"No, it isn't likely, but I believe it will happen. I have a queer, creepy, crawly feeling, you can call it a presentiment if you like, that Patty's Place and I are going to be better acquainted yet."
Chapter 7. Home Again. Those first 3 weeks at Redmond had seemed long, but the rest of the term flew by on wings of wind. Before they realized it, the Redmond students found themselves in the grind of Christmas examinations, emerging therefrom more or less triumphantly. The honor of leading in the freshman classes fluctuated between Anne, Gilbert, and Philippa. Priscilla did very well. Charlie Sloane scraped through respectably and comported himself as complacently as if he had led in everything.
"I can't really believe that this time tomorrow I'll be in Green Gables," said Anne on the night before departure. "But I shall be, and you, Phil, will be in Bolingbrook with Alec and Alonso."
"I'm longing to see them," admitted Phil between the chocolates she was nibbling. "They really are such dear boys, you know. Oh, I'm going to have a splendid time in the holidays. There's to be no end of dances and drives and general jamborees. I shall never forgive you, Queen Anne, for not coming home with me for the holidays."
"Never means 3 days with you, Phil. It was dear of you to ask me, and I'd love to go to Bolingbrook someday, but I can't go this year. I must go home. You don't know how my heart longs for it."
"You won't have much of a time," said Phil scornfully. "There'll be one or two quilting parties, I suppose, and all the old gossips will talk you over to your face and behind your back. You'll die of lonesomeness, child."
"In Avonlea?" said Anne, highly amused.
"Now, if you'd come with me, you'd have a perfectly gorgeous time. Bolingbroke would go wild over you, Queen Anne, your hair and your style and, oh, everything. You're so different. You'd be such a success, and I would bask in reflected glory, not the rose, but near the rose. Do come, after all, Anne."
"Your picture of social triumphs is quite fascinating, Phil, but I'll paint one to offset it. I'm going home to an old country farmhouse, once green, rather faded now, set among leafless apple orchards. There's a brook below and a December firwood beyond, where I've heard harps swept by the fingers of rain and wind. There's a pond nearby that will be gray and brooding now. There will be two oldish ladies in the house, one tall and thin, one short and fat. And there will be two twins, one a perfect model, the other what Mrs. Lynde calls a holy terror. There will be a little room upstairs over the porch, where old dreams hang thick, and a big, fat, glorious feather bed, which will almost seem the height of luxury after a boarding house mattress. How do you like my picture, Phil?"
"It seems a very dull one," said Phil, with a grimace.
"Oh, but I've left out the transforming thing.
said Anne softly. There'll be love there, Phil. Faithful, tender love. Such as I'll never find anywhere else in the world. Love that's waiting for me. That makes my picture a masterpiece, doesn't it? Even if the colors are not very brilliant. Phil silently got up, tossed her box of chocolates away, went up to Anne, and put her arms about her.
Anne, I wish I was like you, she said soberly.
Diana met Anne at the Carmody station the next night, and they drove home together under silent, star-sown depths of sky. Green Gables had a very festal appearance as they drove up the lane. There was a light in every window, the glow breaking out through the darkness like flame-red blossoms swung against the dark background of the haunted wood. And in the yard was a brave bonfire with two gay little figures dancing around it, one of which gave an unearthly yell as the buggy turned in under the poplars.
Davy means that for an Indian war whoop, said Diana. Mr. Harrison's hired boy taught it to him, and he's been practicing it up to welcome you with. Mrs. Lynde says it has worn her nerves to a frazzle. He creeps up behind her, you know, and then lets go. He was determined to have a bonfire for you, too. He's been piling up dry branches for a fortnight and pestering Marilla to be let pour some kerosene oil over it before setting it on fire. I guess she did by the smell, though Mrs. Lynde said up to the last that Davy would blow himself and everybody else up if he was let.
Anne was out of the buggy by this time, and Davy was rapturously hugging her knees, while even Dora was clinging to her hand.
Isn't that a bully bonfire, Anne? Just let me show you how to poke it. You see the sparks? I did it for you, Anne, 'cause I was so glad you were coming home.
The kitchen door opened, and Marilla's spare form darkened against the inner light. She preferred to meet Anne in the shadows, for she was horribly afraid that she was going to cry with joy. She, stern, repressed Marilla, who thought all display of deep emotion unseemly. Mrs. Lynde was behind her, sonsy, kindly, matronly, as of yore. The love that Anne had told Phil was waiting for her, surrounded her and enfolded her with its blessing and its sweetness. Nothing, after all, could compare with the old ties, old friends, and old Green Gables. How starry Anne's eyes were as they sat down to the loaded supper table. How pink her cheeks. How silver clear her laughter. And Diana was going to stay all night, too. How like the dear old times it was. And the rosebud tea set graced the table. With Marilla, the force of nature could no further go.
I suppose you and Diana will now proceed to talk all night, said Marilla sarcastically as the girls went upstairs. Marilla was always sarcastic after any self-betrayal.
Yes, agreed Anne gaily, but I'm going to put Davy to bed first. He insists on that.
You bet, said Davy as they went along the hall. I want somebody to say my prayers to again. It's no fun saying them alone.
You don't say them alone, Davy. God is always with you to hear you.
Well, I can't see him, objected Davy. I want to pray to somebody I can see. But I won't say them to Mrs. Lynde or Marilla. There now.
Nevertheless, when Davy was garbed in his gray flannel nightie, he did not seem in a hurry to begin. He stood before Anne, shuffling one bare foot over the other, and looked undecided. Come, dear, kneel down, said Anne. Davy came and buried his head in Anne's lap, but he did not kneel down.
Anne, he said in a muffled voice, I don't feel like praying after all. I haven't felt like it for a week now. I didn't pray last night, nor the night before.
Why not, Davy? Asked Anne gently.
You won't be mad if I tell you, implored Davy.
Anne lifted the little gray flanneled body on her knee and cuddled his head on her arm.
Do I ever get mad when you tell me things, Davy? No, you never do. But you get sorry, and that's worse. You'll be awful sorry when I tell you this, Anne, and you'll be ashamed of me, I suppose.
Have you done something naughty, Davy? And is that why you can't say your prayers?
No, I haven't done anything naughty yet, but I want to do it.
What is it, Davy?
I want to say a bad word, Anne,
blurted out Davy with a desperate effort.
I heard Mr. Harrison's hired boy say it one day last week. And ever since, I've been wanting to say it all the time, even when I'm saying my prayers.
Well, say it then, Davy. Davy lifted his flushed face in amazement.
But Anne, it's an awful bad word.
Say it.
Davy gave her another incredulous look, then, in a low voice, he said the dreadful word. The next minute his face was burrowing against her.
Oh, Anne, I'll never say it again, never. I'll never want to say it again. I knew it was bad, but I didn't suppose it was so, I didn't suppose it was like that.
No, I don't think you'll ever want to say it again, Davy, or think it either. And I wouldn't go about much with Mr. Harrison's hired boy if I were you.
He can make bully war whoops,
said Davy, a little regretfully. But you don't want your mind filled with bad words, do you, Davy? Words that will poison it and drive out all that is good and manly?
No,
said Davy, owl-eyed with introspection. Then don't go with those people who use them. And now do you feel as if you could say your prayers, Davy?
Oh, yes,
said Davy, eagerly wriggling down on his knees.
I can say them now, all right. I ain't scared now to say, if I should die before I wake, like I was when I was wanting to say that word.
Probably Anne and Diana did empty out their souls to each other that night, but no record of their confidences has been preserved. They both looked as fresh and bright-eyed at breakfast as only youth can look after unlawful hours of revelry and confession. There had been no snow up to this time, but as Diana crossed the old log bridge, on her homeward way, the white flakes were beginning to flutter down over the fields and woods, russet and gray in their dreamless sleep. Soon the faraway slopes and hills were dim and wraith-like through their gauzy scarfing, as if pale autumn had flung a misty bridal veil over her hair and was waiting for her wintry bridegroom. So they had a white Christmas after all, and a very pleasant day it was. In the forenoon, letters and gifts came from Miss Lavendar and Paul. Anne opened them in the cheerful Green Gables kitchen, which was filled with what Davy, sniffing in ecstasy, called pretty smells.
Miss Lavendar and Mr. Irving are settled in their new home now, reported Anne. I am sure Miss Lavendar's perfectly happy. I know it by the general tone of her letter, but there's a note from Charlotta the Fourth. She doesn't like Boston at all, and she is fearfully homesick. Miss Lavendar wants me to go through to Echo Lodge someday while I'm home and light a fire to air it and see that the cushions aren't getting moldy. I think I'll get Diana to go over with me next week, and we can spend the evening with Theodora Dix. I want to see Theodora. By the way, is Ludovic Speed still going to see her?
They say so, said Marilla, and he's likely to continue it. Folks have given up expecting that that courtship will ever arrive anywhere.
I'd hurry him up a bit if I was Theodora, that's what, said Mrs. Lynde,
and there is not the slightest doubt but that she would. There was also a characteristic scrawl from Philippa, full of Alec and Alonzo, what they said and what they did and how they looked when they saw her.
But I can't make up my mind yet which to marry, wrote Phil. I do wish you had come with me to decide for me. Someone will have to. When I saw Alec, my heart gave a great thump and I thought, he must be the right one. And then, when Alonzo came, thump went my heart again. So that's no guide, though it should be, according to all the novels I've ever read. Now, Anne, your heart wouldn't thump for anybody but the genuine Prince Charming, would it? There must be something radically wrong with mine, and I'm having a perfectly gorgeous time. How I wish you were here. It's snowing today, and I'm rapturous. I was so afraid we'd have a green Christmas, and I loathe them. You know when Christmas is a dirty, gray, brownie affair, looking as if it had been left over 100 years ago and had been in soak ever since, it is called a green Christmas. Don't ask me why. As Lord Dundreary says, there are some things no fellow can understand. Anne, did you ever get on a streetcar and then discover that you hadn't any money with you to pay your fare? I did the other day. It's quite awful. I had a nickel with me when I got on the car. I thought it was in the left pocket of my coat. When I got settled down comfortably, I felt for it. It wasn't there. I had a cold chill. I felt in the other pocket. Not there. I had another chill. And then I felt in a little inside pocket. All in vain. I had two chills at once. I took off my gloves, laid them on the seat, and went over all my pockets again. It was not there. I stood up and shook myself, and then looked on the floor. The car was full of people who were going home from the opera, and they all stared at me, but I was past caring for a little thing like that. But I could not find my fare. I concluded I must have put it in my mouth and swallowed it inadvertently. I didn't know what to do. Would the conductor, I wondered, stop the car and put me off in ignominy and shame? Was it possible that I could convince him that I was merely the victim of my own absent-mindedness and not an unprincipled creature trying to obtain a ride upon false pretenses? How I wished that Alec or Alonzo were there. But they weren't because I wanted them. If I hadn't wanted them, they would have been there by the dozen, and I couldn't decide what to say to the conductor when he came around. As soon as I got one sentence of explanation mapped out in my mind, I felt nobody could believe it, and I must compose another. It seemed there was nothing to do but trust in Providence, and for all the comfort that gave me, I might as well have been the old lady who, when told by the captain during a storm that she must put her trust in the Almighty, exclaimed, "Oh, Captain, is it as bad as that?" Just at the conventional moment, when all hope had fled and the conductor was holding out his box to the passenger next to me, I suddenly remembered where I had put that wretched coin of the realm. I hadn't swallowed it after all. I meekly fished it out of the index finger of my glove and poked it in the box. I smiled at everybody and felt that it was a beautiful world. The visit to Echo Lodge was not the least pleasant of many pleasant holiday outings. Anne and Diana went back to it by the old way of the beech woods, carrying a lunch basket with them. Echo Lodge, which had been closed ever since Miss Lavender's wedding, was briefly thrown open to wind and sunshine once more, and firelight glimmered again in the little rooms. The perfume of Miss Lavender's rose bowl still filled the air. It was hardly possible to believe that Miss Lavender would not come tripping in presently, with her brown eyes astar with welcome, and that Charlotta the Fourth, blue of bow and wide of smile, would not pop through the door. Paul, too, seemed hovering around with his fairy fancies. "It really makes me feel a little bit like a ghost, revisiting the old-time glimpses of the moon," laughed Anne. "Let's go out and see if the echoes are at home. Bring the old horn. It is still behind the kitchen door." The echoes were at home, over the white river, as silver clear and multitudinous as ever. And when they had ceased to answer, the girls locked up Echo Lodge again and went away in the perfect half-hour that follows the rose and saffron of a winter sunset. Chapter 8. Anne's First Proposal. The old year did not slip away in a green twilight with a pinky-yellow sunset. Instead, it went out with a wild white bluster and blow. It was one of the nights when the storm wind hurtles over the frozen meadows and black hollows and moans around the eaves like a lost creature and drives the snow sharply against the shaking panes. "Just the sort of night people like to cuddle down between their blankets and count their mercies," said Anne to Jane Andrews, who had come up to spend the afternoon and stay all night. But when they were cuddled between their blankets in Anne's little porch room, it was not her mercies of which Jane was thinking. "Anne," she said very solemnly, "I want to tell you something. May I?" Anne was feeling rather sleepy after the party Ruby Gillis had given the night before. She would much rather have gone to sleep than listen to Jane's confidences, which she was sure would bore her. She had no prophetic inkling of what was coming. Probably Jane was engaged, too. Rumor averred that Ruby Gillis was engaged to the Spencervale schoolteacher, about whom all the girls were said to be quite wild. "I'll soon be the only fancy-free maiden of our old quartet," thought Anne drowsily. Aloud, she said, "Of course." "Anne," said Jane, still more solemnly, "what do you think of my brother Billy?" Anne gasped over this unexpected question and floundered helplessly in her thoughts. Goodness, what did she think of Billy Andrews? She had never thought anything about him. Round-faced, stupid, perpetually smiling, good-natured Billy Andrews. Did anybody ever think about Billy Andrews?
I don't understand, Jane," she stammered. "What do you mean exactly?"
"Do you like Billy?" asked Jane bluntly.
Why, yes, I like him, of course," gasped Anne, wondering if she were telling the literal truth. Certainly she did not dislike Billy, but could the indifferent tolerance with which she regarded him, when he happened to be in her range of vision, be considered positive enough for liking? What was Jane trying to elucidate?
"Would you like him for a husband?"
asked Jane calmly. A husband? Anne had been sitting up in bed, the better to wrestle with the problem of her exact opinion of Billy Andrews. Now she fell flatly back on her pillows, the very breath gone out of her.
Whose husband?
Yours, of course, answered Jane. Billy wants to marry you. He's always been crazy about you, and now Father has given him the upper farm in his own name, and there's nothing to prevent him from getting married. But he's so shy he couldn't ask you himself if you'd have him, so he got me to do it. I'd rather not have, but he gave me no peace till I said I would, if I got a good chance.
Would you think about it, Anne?
Was it a dream? Was it one of those nightmare things in which you'd find yourself engaged or married to someone you hate or don't know without the slightest idea how it ever came about? No, she, Anne Shirley, was lying there wide awake in her own bed, and Jane Andrews was beside her, calmly proposing for her brother Billy. Anne did not know whether she wanted to writhe or laugh, but she could do neither, for Jane's feelings must not be hurt.
I couldn't marry Billy, you know, Jane, she managed to gasp. Why, such an idea never occurred to me, never.
I don't suppose it did, agreed Jane. Billy has always been far too shy to think of courting. But you might think it over, Anne. Billy is a good fellow. I must say that, if he is my brother. He has no bad habits and he's a great worker, and you can depend on him. A bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. He told me to tell you he'd be quite willing to wait till you got through college, if you insisted, though he'd rather get married this spring before the planting begins. He'd always be very good to you, I'm sure, and you know, Anne, I'd love to have you for a sister.
I can't marry Billy, said Anne decidedly. She had recovered her wits and was even feeling a little angry. It was all so ridiculous. There is no use thinking of it, Jane. I don't care anything for him in that way, and you must tell him so.
Well, I didn't suppose you would, said Jane with a resigned sigh, feeling that she had done her best. I told Billy I didn't believe it was a bit of use to ask you, but he insisted. Well, you've made your decision, Anne, and I hope you won't regret it.
Jane spoke rather coldly. She had been perfectly sure that the enamored Billy had no chance at all of inducing Anne to marry him. Nevertheless, she felt a little resentment that Anne Shirley, who was, after all, merely an adopted orphan, without kith or kin, should refuse her brother, one of the Avonlea Andrews. Well, pride sometimes goes before a fall, Jane reflected ominously. Anne permitted herself to smile in the darkness over the idea that she might ever regret not marrying Billy Andrews. I hope Billy won't feel very badly over it, she said nicely. Jane made a movement as if she were tossing her head on her pillow.
Oh, he won't break his heart. Billy has too much good sense for that. He likes Nettie Blewett pretty well, too, and Mother would rather he married her than anyone. She's such a good manager and saver. I think when Billy is once sure you won't have him, he'll take Nettie. Please don't mention this to anyone, will you, Anne?
Certainly not, said Anne, who had no desire whatever to publish abroad the fact that Billy Andrews wanted to marry her, preferring her, when all was said and done, to Nettie Blewett. Nettie Blewett!
And now I suppose we'd better go to sleep, suggested Jane. To sleep went Jane easily and speedily. But though very unlike Macbeth in most respects, she had certainly contrived to murder sleep for Anne. That proposed to damsel lay on a wakeful pillow until the wee smalls, but her meditations were far from being romantic. It was not, however, until the next morning that she had an opportunity to indulge in a good laugh over the whole affair. When Jane had gone home, still with a hint of frost in voice and manner, because Anne had declined so ungratefully and decidedly the honor of an alliance with the House of Andrews, Anne retreated to the porch room, shut the door, and had her laugh out at last.
If I could only share the joke with someone, she thought, but I can't. Diana is the only one I'd want to tell, and even if I hadn't sworn secrecy to Jane, I can't tell Diana things now. She tells everything to Fred, I know she does. Well, I've had my first proposal. I supposed it would come someday, but I certainly never thought it would be by proxy. It's awfully funny. And yet there's a sting in it, too, somehow.
Anne knew quite well wherein the sting consisted, though she did not put it into words. She had had her secret dreams of the first time someone should ask her the great question. And it had, in those dreams, always been very romantic and beautiful, and the someone was to be very handsome and dark-eyed and distinguished-looking and eloquent, whether he were Prince Charming to be enraptured with yes, or one to whom a regretful, beautifully worded but hopeless refusal must be given. If the latter, the refusal was to be expressed so delicately that it would be next best thing to acceptance, and he would go away after kissing her hand, assuring her of his unalterable lifelong devotion, and it would always be a beautiful memory to be proud of and a little sad about also. And now this thrilling experience had turned out to be merely grotesque. Billy Andrews had got his sister to propose for him because his father had given him the upper farm, and if Anne wouldn't have him, Nettie Blewett would. There was romance for you, with a vengeance. Anne laughed, and then sighed. The bloom had been brushed from one little maiden dream. Would the painful process go on until everything became prosaic and humdrum?